Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, November 22nd. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, now accepting applications for a wide range of job and career opportunities at the hospital and outpatient offices across the greater capital, I should say greater Saratoga region, saratogahospital.org/careers. Joining us today to discuss neurology and dementia is Dr. David Hart of Albany Med Neurology. He is here to answer your questions about a range of neurological maladies, and I advise you to call early today, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Hart and your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us on this Medical Monday to discuss Alzheimer's disease and other neurological issues is Dr. David Hart of Albany Med. Dr. Hart treats diseases of the brain, spinal cord, nerves, and muscles. He diagnoses and treats dementias, strokes, epilepsy, headaches, MS, Parkinson's, and a wide range of other neurological illnesses. He's been a part of the Alzheimer's Center at Albany Med since 2015, with over 20 years of private practice. Prior to that, Dr. Hart is an associate professor of neurology at Albany Medical College. If you have a question for Dr. Hart, call now, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org, and I'm monitoring the email box. We'll get to the email bag later in the show, but once again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. David Hart, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Ray. It's great to be here.
What do we know concretely about the causes of Alzheimer's?
That's a great question, and there's either a great answer or no answer at all. So we know, you know, going back 110 years to when Dr. Alzheimer first presented a case, that there are two key changes in the brain. There is a buildup of amyloid protein in plaques in the brain, these little protein coagulations in the substance of the brain. And then there are these twists of tau protein within the nerve cells themselves that we call neurofibrillary tangles. So you could look at those as being the cause of Alzheimer's disease, or you could ask the great question of why it is that that happens. And nobody really knows that answer.
Okay, that is where I was going with this. A week ago tomorrow, Brigham and Women's Hospital put out a press release. They're launching a clinical trial of a nasal vaccine for Alzheimer's disease. And I thought to myself, my God, is this communicable? I mean, what do we know about this angle?
Well, I think that in the late 90s, the first Alzheimer's vaccine came about, and that was a vaccine that was targeting amyloid protein. So this is 1998 or so. People got an injection of amyloid protein along with something called an adjuvant, something that gears up the immune system. And the idea was that your body would then create an immune response against amyloid, attack it in the brain, and get it out. Problem with that is that it turned out this vaccine caused a lot of sort of bystander inflammation, and a significant number of people in the trial developed encephalitis. And that was seen as a bad thing. The trial was ended, and we then moved from active to what's called passive immunization. Instead of trying to make the brain, make the body develop an immune response, we gave people antibodies to give them sort of a packaged immune response so that you could control the dose, you could stop it if you needed to, have more safety control over it. And that's what's been the mainstay of Alzheimer's research for the last couple of decades.
The last paragraph of this press release from Brigham and Women's Hospital really piqued my interest. It said, the immune system plays a very important role in all neurologic diseases. And I wish you could shed some light on that for those of us who don't know a lot about this stuff.
Okay. Well, I would say that like so much else that happens in the brain, it is a subject of debate. And if you think about the very protected status of the brain, it makes sense why that would be the case. It's very hard to pull pieces of the brain out of a living individual and look at them and evaluate them without harming the individual. It's not like doing a heart muscle biopsy or a lung biopsy or something like that. You know, every different part of the brain does something different. So it's hard. We have to have non-invasive means of studying it. And that's something that we're just getting to. But I mean,
do you believe that immune system has a great deal to do with the onset of neurological illnesses?
In some illnesses, very clearly so. In others, it's not entirely clear how much of it is causative, how much of it is reactive. And that's really a key question. Is the immune system activating abnormally and causing the problem, or is the immune system trying to clean up for the problem and just not up to the task?
Dr. David Hart of Albany Med joins us today. Our number on Medical Monday is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. But let's go to the phones, and we'll start with Bob in Broad Auburn. Bob, you're on.
Oh, thank you. The subject focuses upon amputee phantom pain. My question, and obviously the pain is being created by the brain, presumably some section or segment of the memory neurons in the brain. But my question, are you aware of any cure for this? And I don't think that there is. But I'm wanting to focus on the possibility of using, during an episode of phantom pain, functional magnetic resonance imaging to identify that particular specific area of the brain that is triggering phantom pain. And would it then, if that were possible and worked, use beam imaging and beam radiation to destroy that area of the brain that is triggering the phantom pain? Usually a prescription of gabapentin is used these days in order to ameliorate the pain and assist the nervous system in quieting down. Are you aware of any research in this field, this area of identifying the source of the phantom pain in the brain area?
Well, I think that that the location of phantom pain is the somatosensory cortex. That's where sensory information is processed, and I believe that functional MRI studies have already shown that to be the case. You're right, there is no specific cure for phantom limb pain. Whether that's coming from an alteration in the brain or whether that's a result of an altered sensory signal coming up from peripheral nerves that normally would be originating in the now absent limb, you know, you could argue about that. It's not my primary area of interest. If you tried to destroy the part of the brain that was experiencing that pain, I think that you'd have a lot of sort of bystander damage, and I think that the side effects would be much worse than the benefit you would get from it.
Bob, thank you very much for the call. Dr. David Hart joins us today on Medical Monday, and the number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Christine in Watervliet writes, have you heard about some research linking hearing loss and Alzheimer's? Any thoughts on that research?
Yeah, so there was a blue ribbon panel put together by Lancet and some of the international dementia organizations, 10 years ago, something like that,
yeah,
looking at modifiable risk factors for Alzheimer's. And they came up with a list of 9 risk factors. And they said if we address all of these fully, we could drop the amount of dementia worldwide by a third. One of these 9 risk factors was hearing loss, especially hearing loss in midlife. And if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense because people who have hearing loss are not getting as much cognitive stimulation. In addition, a lot of people who have hearing loss will try to avoid situations where their hearing is going to be challenged. They don't want to go into the same social situations because they don't want to have to ask people to repeat themselves. They don't want to look stupid if they don't hear and process well what somebody's saying. Thirdly, when your hearing is iffy but not gone, when people are talking to you, you're spending part of your time decoding what they're saying. So you hear the words, your brain is processing that information and trying to make sense of it, which is much slower for you than it would have been when your hearing was normal. So instead of just following along with the subject of discussion, you're caught way behind because your brain has this much slower processing. And so that means you're not getting as much information in and you're feeling self-conscious about it and very likely. And so people definitely try to limit their exposure in that case. And I think that's a part of the problem.
But how would that, in other words, how would being hard of hearing end up leading to a very physical condition that is Alzheimer's?
Well, we know that a brain that is exercised does better, lives longer. We know that a brain that has more education does better and has a lower risk of dementia. The higher your education level, the lower your risk of dementia. The later in life that you work, sadly, the lower your risk of dementia. So keeping the brain stimulated, the greater your degree of social engagement, the lower your risk of developing a dementia. So the things that you know, kind of shake the dust out of the system, keep the brain healthy, help to suppress the process of dementia.
That is interesting information. So if you were theoretically a 72-year-old shut-in who didn't interact with the world, your odds are much higher of developing dementia.
Right, as opposed to if you were a 72-year-old who was retired, but you were in a bunch of community organizations, including Meals on Wheels, bringing meals to that shut-in. Yeah.
Dr. David Hart joins us. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Medical Monday, and we will be back. Vox Pop on WAMC. It's Medical Monday with Ray Graff. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We're joined today by Dr. David Hart of Albany Med. This email, Dr. Hart from Mandy. Guidance with early onset dementia. Albany Med neurologists have told my father he has the onset of dementia. Where can he and our family find help understanding and dealing with his current symptoms and planning for the future? We've been given medical info, but need guidance on dealing with day-to-day activities and behaviors, both for him and the family. And that's from Mandy.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I would wholeheartedly endorse reaching out to the Alzheimer's Association, alz.org. They do something called a care consultation where they will meet either in person or remotely with a patient and family, and they will they've got a lot of resources of information to provide, and they like to sit down with folks and try and figure out where they are and what they need and how best to provide that. So that's probably the first thing I would do if your dad or father-in-law, if they are being seen at Albany Med, then asking to meet with the social work staff from the Alzheimer's Center might be of some help as well. We have the Eddie in the Capital District, which has Eddie Alzheimer's Services, and that's another great resource. So we have a number of good resources in upstate New York, which is great.
Having now seen this firsthand with a family member, you really do at times have this overwhelming sense of helplessness. And there's at some points, there's really not a lot you can do. I mean, there is anger at times with these as the dementia progresses, and family members often just are at a loss.
Oh, absolutely. It's enormously stressful. It's stressful putting up with the behaviors. It's stressful putting up with the deficits. It's really stressful watching the loss of somebody that you know and love. People are just not the person that they used to be. Sometimes there's an answer, and sometimes just having somebody to reach out to. So the Alzheimer's Association has a 24-hour helpline, and I don't have that number memorized, but again, you can get it from alz.org. And the helpline is staffed by people, not computers, 24 hours a day. And so, you know, in the middle of the night, they're driving you crazy and you just need to talk to somebody, there is somebody there.
Dr. David Hart joins us today from Albany Med. It's Medical Monday on WAMC. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Sam writes, what is the doctor's thoughts on psychedelics use of the brain?
Well, I guess that's an interesting question. There are certainly some psychoactive agents, and not necessarily psychedelics, but psychoactive agents which may have some therapeutic use in dementia. We know that agents like ketamine can have some use in depression. We know that there are receptors in the brain, the endocannabinoid receptors, which respond to cannabinoid substances. That's why people respond to marijuana. And that these receptors help to produce calming, help to reduce anxiety. And so it may be that cannabinoids, that THC, that marijuana or marijuana derivatives may have some benefit in managing agitation or anxiety in dementia patients. So that's an interesting area that needs to be looked into.
And, you mentioned May. It may have. For years, the federal prohibition on this has meant a lack of studies. We are seeing some states open now, still not on the federal level. Are there chances now to study some of these substances that have been on the federal blacklist for all this time?
I think that's still a very murky question. The big issue is that if it's not okay with the federal government, then the federal government's not going to pay for that kind of research. So the NIH is not going to fund that kind of research. And NIH is the single biggest funder of basic science medical research worldwide. So until that can change, that's a huge roadblock. And then, if researchers do have the okay from their state but not from the federal government, they always have to worry about, what may happen down the road if they do this kind of research. Is somebody going to come after them down the line? So that's got a suppressive effect on it as well.
Dr. David Hart is with us. One more email, doctor, and then we'll go back to the phones. And our number is 800-348-2551. This one is from Nikki. And we had a gastroenterologist on last week, and this topic came up quite a bit. Can we have the doc comment on the correlation between proton pump inhibitors such as omeprazole and cognitive decline?
It's another situation where I think there's clearly an association, but it's not so clear whether that's cause and effect. So as an example, a number of years ago, there was a paper showing an association between the use of statins for cholesterol and dementia. And so many people panicked and said, I've got to get off my statin right away. I've got to get off atorvastatin or Lipitor or, things like that because it'll cause dementia.
Right.
And then a subsequent paper looked at much more carefully at it, and they controlled for vascular risk factors. And they found that if you took two groups who had the same vascular risk factors, some of whom got a statin and some of whom didn't, the folks who got the statin had a lower risk of dementia, not a higher risk. So if you were controlling for that, then it was clear that there was some benefit to the statin being used. So I'm not sure whether that's really been done with the proton pump inhibitors, as somebody with a family history that ran down to me of reflux esophagitis. And we're joking last weekend when I was with my my siblings about the Italian phrase agita that was often directed at one of us, perhaps me in particular, as a cause. And now it's someday you'll get yours has come home to roost. So I hope that it's not causative.
Yeah, I have a couple of children who are causative of agita myself. But let's go back to the phones. Dr. David Hart joins us today. Brian is in Shelburne Falls. Brian, you're on.
Thank you, Ray. Ray, once again, I appreciate all you do on the radio station. I'm glad you're there.
Appreciate it.
You're more than welcome. You deserve it. And Dr. Hart, I so appreciate your field of study. A couple of weeks ago on the program Science Friday, there was a Dr. Pasquale. He's an assistant professor of psychiatry and neurology at University of Pittsburgh. Was there to be interviewed about his article on inflammation, tau, and amyloid that's in the Nature Medicine Journal, Volume 27 of September this year. And his study showed that they found that they can have patients with tau and amyloid, but if there's an absence of inflammation, there wasn't any signs, except normal aging, of Alzheimer's, which kind of backed up Dr. Eagleman's mentioning of, I'm sure you're familiar with, the nun study, that when they did cross sections of nuns that have donated their brains from a retirement home that they're in at the age of in their 90s and hundreds, they had the tau and the amyloid, but no inflammation. Hence, they weren't showing signs of Alzheimer's. And that, if that's true, and something to be studied more, would a anti-inflammatory diet and exercise and lifestyle of being compassionate to yourself, grateful and compassionate to all beings, an anti-inflammatory approach to life, reducing anxiety, stress, distress, be helpful to offset that inflammation that seems to be a triggerer of Alzheimer's? Thank you for allowing me to take that question so long.
Thanks, Brian.
Sure. Well, I think that it's very clear that people who eat a healthful diet, people who eat something resembling the Mediterranean diet or the MIND or DASH diets, all of which focus on more seafood, less red meat, more fresh fruits, nuts, vegetables, less refined sugar, sadly, less chocolate chip cookies, that these folks have a lower risk of developing dementia. I think that it remains a very interesting question, and you have to, you know, really be picky about this and ask, was there no inflammation and that's why these folks didn't have dementia? Or was it that whatever the next step in the process was that would have provoked an inflammatory response had just not occurred yet? So I'm not sure that answer is out there yet. But the better you treat yourself, the better you're going to be in the long run. Exercise and eat right, get enough sleep.
Brian, do you want to follow up?
Yes, and just in terms of lifestyle, in terms of, thank you, Ray, in terms of living a life where we are grateful, and that's a form of self-compassion, and then being in this reflective mode versus reactive mode, and being compassionate to all beings we meet, and making our corrections when we're not, would add to reducing that inflammation, the stress, distress in our life, which would be a factor of inflammation.
But that would be hard to study scientifically, right?
You're hired. That was about to be my my answer. That you know, people who treat themselves better, who you know try to have a more optimistic view, tend to be happier, tend to function better. But whether that translates into a lower inflammatory profile or a change in the milieu of the brain in terms of inflammation, I don't know, and that would be very difficult to study at this point, I think.
Brian, thanks a lot for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Along those lines, Mike writes, chess. Just a thought on brain stimulation. The U.S. Chess Federation is going to do a study because they can't think of one chess master who developed dementia.
That's interesting.
There's a shrug that doesn't work on the radio, but I can see your point. So there's not really much, no inference that you can draw from that.
Well, I think that there is good evidence that people who keep their brains working and keep their bodies working, there's a very strong benefit to physical exercise. And that's probably the biggest thing, at least in our society, that gets overlooked. I joke with my patients that most Americans either exercise too much or too little. And, most of us go about doing too little of it. But there's very good evidence that physical exercise promotes the release of a couple of different neurogenic hormones. Now, when I was in medical school in the 80s, the belief was that when you were born or shortly thereafter, a few months afterwards, you had all the brain cells that you were ever going to have.
Right.
You could generate new nerve cells elsewhere in the body, but never in the brain. Turns out that that's wrong. In fact, the brain makes new nerve cells all through adult life. And when it does it, it primarily does it in the hippocampus, which is a short-term memory encoding structure and often the first target, at least macroscopically, in Alzheimer's disease.
So then can you say that the brain is trying to basically do system updates to prevent dementia?
I guess that's an interesting way of looking at it. I just would look at it in terms of, things that help the brain to regenerate itself are going to keep your brain healthier longer. And so physical exercise is a big part of that. 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week, or an hour a day, 3 days a week of what we call sweaty exercise, something where you're actually doing some work and getting the heart pumping harder and, making the muscles work, has very strong cognitive benefits.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Our guest is Dr. David Hart of Albany Med, and we'll go back to the phones in one moment. First, an email from Maria, who apparently may be a colleague of yours. Maria writes, is there a possibility that a person can have both Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease at the same time, and what would be the percent of damage to the brain?
So Alzheimer's accounts for about 65% of dementias. Vascular dementia, probably 10 or 20%. Dementia with Lewy bodies, 10 or 20%. And then there are smaller proportions made up by many other illnesses. You can have dementia from Parkinson's disease, or you can have Parkinson's without dementia. And just because you have one bad thing going on in the brain does not prevent you from having another. It's very common, probably 20% or 30% of people with dementia have mixed pathology. Maybe it's even higher than that. And the only way to really quantify that would be taking a look at the brain under a microscope. But I would say also that about 25% of patients with moderate and late-stage Alzheimer's develop something called Parkinsonism. It's not quite Parkinson's disease. They look kind of like Parkinson's disease with some minor differences, but the problem is not just a deterioration of the neurons in the substantia nigra, which is where Parkinson's comes from, but deteriorations in the connections to that part of the brain. And so these people look a lot like somebody who has Parkinson's disease, although it's really something that's a little bit different.
Dr. David Hart is our guest today. Jim is in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
Are there any pathognomonic postmortem lesions with other forms of dementia?
Well, there's the accumulation of tau protein or of TDP-43 in the frontotemporal dementias. There are the spongiform degeneration changes in the neurons in Jakob Creutzfeldt disease or mad cow disease. Each of the dementias, with the exception of alcoholic dementia, I think, each of the dementias has some characteristic pathologic signature.
Thank you.
We're joined today by Dr. David Hart of Albany Med. The number is 800-348-2551. You mentioned imaging. Well, you mentioned looking at a brain under a microscope, which is probably something you can't do until the patient is dead, or maybe you can. I don't know. But are there ways other than judging someone's behavior to really get a good handle on the progression of dementia? Can you image? Is there some imaging that works?
Yeah, there is. So there is amyloid imaging. And if you don't have amyloid buildup in the brain, then you don't have Alzheimer's disease. But amyloid is close to fully accumulated in the brain by the time people develop symptoms. It's been building up in the brain for a couple of decades before people really develop symptoms. So you can't really go by that. Tau protein, though, accumulates in a more localized fashion and in a fashion that associates temporally with disease stage much better. So tau tends to build up in the medial temporal lobes first, and it tends to build up in the parietal lobes after that, and it tends to build up in a more generalized pattern after that. And it correlates pretty well with pathologic staging of Alzheimer's based on autopsy series. So there's that, and there are other, very cool imaging techniques coming along that will give us better and better answers.
There is no way, once the amyloids are at full level, they've taken a couple of decades, the patient is exhibiting symptoms, there is no way to physically remove amyloids, or is it just that not a worthy thing to even try?
Well, it's possible to do it, and the question remains whether it's a worthy thing to do or not. So been a lot of talk in the last 6 months about aducanumab, or Aduhelm. This is the first agent approved by the FDA for disease modification in Alzheimer's disease. And this is a monoclonal antibody. This is a packaged antibody that's been designed to remove amyloid from the brain. And the studies that led to its approval by the FDA showed a great effectiveness in getting amyloid out of the brain. If you did an amyloid PET scan, which all of these patients in this trial had to have done in order to get into the study, at the end of the treatment phase, the folks who had the high dose of aducanumab, their brain PET imaging would not have allowed them into the study any longer because they didn't have enough amyloid there. So it is possible to get a good bit of amyloid out of the brain. The question is, how much of a difference does that make? The controversy, one of the controversies with aducanumab was that the change in amyloid was pretty striking, but the difference in terms of disease progression was statistically significant, but in overall terms was small.
Well, you mentioned that it takes some delay between the full amyloid load in the brain and symptoms really progressing. Is it possible that removing those amyloids, there would be a delay in the symptoms receding?
It's possible, and it's also possible that the damage has been done by that point. Now, there's a meeting just going on over the last few days, CTAD, it's Clinical Trials in Alzheimer's Disease, and I haven't seen the paper yet, but there was a presentation indicating that in one of the antibody trials recently, that in addition to getting amyloid out of the brain, they lowered the amount of tau in the brain. And so that's a very interesting finding, and we'll have to see how that really translates into how people do in day-to-day life.
Dr. David Hart joins us today on Medical Monday. And the number is 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop on WAMZ. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. We're joined today by Dr. David Hart of Albany Med. And, Doctor, a few emails here, and then we'll go back to the phones. This one is from Anna. On my mother's side of my family, my grandmother suffered, and now my mom suffers with Alzheimer's dementia. I see it in my future, and I'd like to see if there are ways to help delay or prevent it. I feel I have memory loss and lose train of thought and words at times. I'm in my mid-40s. I brought this to my general doctor, and she gave me a paper test, and nothing really came of it. What kind of tests are to be done? Brain scan? Blood? Hey, and that nasal vaccine seems interesting. Can you please mention it again so I could further research it?
Okay.
That's from Anna.
Yeah. So there's a difference between early onset and late onset Alzheimer's disease. Early onset is defined as onset before age 65. About 40% of early onset Alzheimer's disease is due to a single gene mutation, presenilin-1, presenilin-2, or amyloid precursor protein. If you have one of these gene abnormalities, then you're going to develop Alzheimer's disease. And you're going to do it at about the same age as your parents and your grandparents because the age of onset is pretty well conserved. But most of these people have onset well before age 50, often before age 40. So when you're talking about people who have onset, you know, 55 or 60 or 65, it's a tragedy, but it's less commonly due to a single gene mutation. Mm. In people with late onset disease, after age 65, there doesn't seem to be any single gene that accounts for it. And so, you know, in my situation, my grandparent had Alzheimer's. My mom's in a nursing home with Alzheimer's. And it's something that I think about, my siblings think about. But we don't have the same risk of somebody who's got a family history of early onset disease. I think the prevention strategies are the same no matter what your situation is, that being physically active, getting in that 30 minutes a day of sweaty exercise, eating healthy, keeping your blood pressure under control, keeping your sugar under control, avoiding excessive alcohol, avoiding smoking, keeping your brain working. Those are the best ways to try and maintain cognitive health into later life.
This email from Mary, and you know, a note to our listeners, especially on a Medical Monday, I certainly get the need for a detailed email, but these emails can be very long and the show will be over. But I'll try to make my best edits on the fly here. 6 years ago, I suffered a closed-head traumatic brain injury, which resulted in a drawn-out recovery for balance, speech, cognitive, and visual insufficiencies. After about 4 years of therapy, I reached my plateau. I am now living with a permanent convergent insufficiency of my eyes. Additionally, I've been told that my eyes move and very minute jittery patterns that were studied and noted by doctors at SUNY College of Optometry in New York City, research and treatment center for which I hold in high esteem as they provide the only medical specialization that I visited that affirmed my visual struggles as they related to TBI. My question is this: what type of nerve injury occurred so as to cause a visual convergence insufficiency and erratic eye movement? Why would recovery from a closed-head TBI injury, impact was to the left frontal cortex right above the eye, leave visual insufficiency when balanced speech and cognitive recovery were more successful over time?
All right, so first off, convergence insufficiency is an inability to get the eyes to narrow enough to point towards the midline enough to keep something in focus as it gets closer. Something's far away, your eyes can point straight ahead and you'll have it in your center of vision.
Yeah.
But as it gets closer, the eyes have to start pointing more towards the nose. Picture, you know, two film cameras. As a runner moving towards the cameras gets closer, those cameras have to keep moving in with the runner. They have to keep pointing in towards the center of the field of view.
Yeah.
So when you don't do that well, that is convergence insufficiency. Second thing to understand is that the eye movements are controlled in the end by nuclei in the brainstem. And this is the stalk of the brain that connects the hemispheres with the spinal cord. It's not just a highway of information flowing north and south. There are also some control centers in there, especially for the eye movements. What happens in a TBI, very often if there's a blow to the head, there's a shockwave that passes through the brain, and usually, often anyway, there is some torque associated with that. So it's not just a front and back shockwave. There may be a twisting component of it. If you realize that the neurons are not just a wire going from point A to point B, but they're a wire that's got lots of little fronds all along its route and that it's interconnected with all the other wires that are near it, when that shockwave goes through, it can interrupt those dendritic connections. And that seems to be the pathogenesis of a lot of what happens in traumatic brain injury. And so if that happens in the brainstem, as is commonly the case, then the eye movements are abnormal as a result.
One more email, and then back to the phones we will go. This one's from Joey in Rosendale. A friend has been diagnosed with pseudo-dementia, i.e. dementia brought on by trauma. Psychotherapy had been recommended, but talk therapy appears out of the question for an individual who has a great difficulty finding words. I'd like to hear any insights you can offer on pseudo-dementia. And that's from Joey in Rosendale.
Well, pseudo-dementia typically refers to something which appears to be but is not dementia. And that usually refers to people who are depressed and they look like they're demented, but they are not. So again, going back to the good old days when we knew everything, it was very clear that some folks were depressed in later years and they were not demented. They were just depressed. And that's the thing that had to be treated. Now we know that if you didn't have depression earlier in life, that and you get it in late life, you have a very high risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. Maybe that ties into what we were talking about earlier, that the process in the brain that is causing Alzheimer's disease is going on for a couple of decades before you develop symptoms. And so maybe that's what's causing that depression. The fact that somebody has a dementia that's not from Alzheimer's or not from frontotemporal dementia doesn't make it not dementia. You can have dementia from head injury. You can have dementia from infection, encephalitis, HIV can cause dementia. And these are all true dementias. They're not a pseudo-dementia. So I guess I'm not sure that the term is necessarily being used the right way or maybe not being explained all the way.
Dr. David Hart joins us. And back to the phones we go. Tom is in Latham. Tom, you're on.
Thanks for taking my call. Touching on something you touched on a little while ago, I'm curious about where the research is about memory loss that's considered to be quote-unquote normal versus something that might be a warning sign of something more serious that lead, perhaps early early Alzheimer's or other or something else. You know, I'll give you an example. I'm in my mid-50s, and I was one of the guys that you wanted to have at, say, at a Trivial Pursuit game to answer your trivial entertainment questions. I you know, the most minute, obscure questions I could answer, no problem. Not too long ago, I was having a conversation with somebody. We were talking about the TV show Maude, and I could not even remember the name of the actress who played Maude, Bea Arthur. And it was a scary, scary moment. I've never experienced any kind of memory loss like that. And in the last number of months, I've had very similar situations where things I would have normally had recalled instantaneously, I just can't remember for the life of me. And I'm wondering, where do I be, you know, at what point do I begin to become concerned that things that would be normally within my memory, you know, within something that I could remember, no longer can remember.
Okay.
Well, Tom, there's a common phenomenon often when people hit their 50s that they start having trouble coming up with proper nouns, names of people and places, and that is considered a normal part of aging and is not necessarily an indicator of an oncoming dementia. Sometimes people have the experience of walking into a room and forgetting why you walked in there. You set something down, you forget where you put it. And a lot of times people get concerned by that, and they think that it's an indicator of dementia coming on. More often, it's a sign of people being distracted. Sometimes, though, it's hard to know for sure whether the bit of forgetfulness that somebody has is a sign of a problem or whether it's benign. You know, mm-hmm. We use these scales. We use the Mini-Mental State Exam, which is a 30-point scale. We use the Montreal Cognitive Assessment, which is another more sensitive scale, looking for early memory loss. And, you know, if you score a 29 on the MoCA, the perfect score is 30. If you score a 29, then, you know, probably things are good. But maybe you're somebody who's got a PhD and, you know, is a very highly literate person, and normal for you would have been 30, and 29 is a bit of a decline. And it may be that only following that over time will give you that answer. So,
all right. Well, Tom, thank you very much for the call. Should everyone have a baseline test of this sort when they're in their 20s or 30s? Something you could look back on in the 50s and 60s and say, well, okay.
No, I don't think so, but I think that older folks should have annual cognitive screening. I think that that's much more cost-effective and meaningful. And one of the advantages of the Affordable Care Act was putting in place something called a Medicare wellness visit. An annual visit and a cognitive screening is supposed to be a part of that. So it doesn't have to be very intensive, but, you know, doing things like having people draw a clock, remember a couple of words, do, you know, some simple exercises of that nature can be a pretty good way of looking for imminent problems.
Dr. David Hart is our guest on this Medical Monday. We go to New Paltz, and Frankie, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Hart. Hey, Ray.
Hey.
My comment and my question has to do with my mom had dementia and eventually Alzheimer's, and she did pass away. You know, it was a decline and went over for a period of years. The question I have, you started talking in the last email, a few emails ago, about the genes. And, you know, I had my genealogy done. We don't have the precursor or the marker for dementia, but we have hypertension, high blood pressure. My mom had diabetes. So I'm wondering, is there a connection between diabetes and Alzheimer's? I don't know if you talked about this earlier in the show. But,
no, we didn't address that, but yes.
Some of us in my... Yeah, I'm sorry. Go
Frankie.
Ahead, Dr. Hart.
I didn't mean to cut you off. I was just going to say there's a very strong link there. And having diabetes certainly doubles and maybe triples your risk of developing dementia down the road. And that's...
Why is that?
That's
So that was my question. You know, there's 9 brothers and sisters. We're trying to live a healthy life. We're all between 50 and 65. Mom died at 85. And again, since we don't have the gene, I think it's environmental what happened to mom, in the sense that, you know, her diet and eventually her diabetes, right, that affected her. So there is a connection there, huh?
Yes, there is. And Ray was asking why that is, which is a great question. We know that one of the enzymes, enzyme subunits that's involved in amyloid processing is also a part of an insulin receptor in the brain. So there's there's a kind of a biochemical link there. The higher your blood sugar is, the less healthy your blood vessels are, and anything that's bad for the pipes is bad for the brain and increases your Alzheimer's risk. We know that even a transient elevation in your blood sugar can lead to a pretty rapid impairment in cognitive functioning. So there's a lot of different avenues that they may interact.
All right. Wow. So just continue to eat healthy and try to stay as healthy as possible and, you know, in our life and active, like you said, brain
Eat healthy.
Right?
Eat healthy. Keep your blood pressure under control. Keep your blood sugar under control. Take care of yourself.
Frankie, thanks a lot for the call. With all that we have learned about diagnosing and getting to perhaps not the root, but some of the causes of Alzheimer's and related dementia, why no cure? Why nothing resembling a cure yet?
I think it comes down to the fact that you know, the changes that are occurring that are causing this problem have been going on for a long time before we get there. That we know these pathologic hallmarks that Dr. Alzheimer described in 1905, but we're not sure why they occur. And it's very difficult to study this in the living brain. So as you know, it's got the skull around it. It's a unique organ in which every part of it is vital for something. And so it makes it very difficult to study this and get to the point where we have a solution.
The interesting thing about the brain, I only know what I see on the Science Channel, but it seems to have this capacity to rewire itself when there is an injury. Is there a way that the brain can compensate? It figures out, okay, this part of the frontal lobe not happening, I will rewire and do something else.
That has certainly been an area for research. That's neural plasticity is the concept that the brain can rewire itself. And the younger you are, the easier that is. You know, kids who have a massive stroke in utero may have very few sequela from it. And patients who, you know, have the same sort of thing later on are devastated by it. So there is a flexibility of the brain that we lose as we age, and that's another thing that we need to better understand.
Well, Dr. David Hart, there's so much to discuss. I hope you come back again soon. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Ray. It's been a pleasure.
Support comes from Dr. Sarcino and McGuire Podiatrists, with offices in Greenwich, New York, at Bennington, Vermont, Surgery for the Foot and Ankle, nyfootsurge.com, for more information. Once again, thanks to Dr. David Hart of Albany Med Neurology for being with us today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the great calls. I apologize if we didn't get to your call or email. We will have Dr. David Hart back as soon as he can tolerate coming back for another hour. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phones screened on Mondays by Joe Makowicz. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on the program, something very, very exciting. I don't want to tell the doctor, but I forgot what it was. But I'll look on a piece of paper. We'll find out tomorrow. See you at 2 o'clock tomorrow. Media Project is next.